A roller coaster of emotions, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A tense week ends in Venezuela with no change in the country's political standoff, and opposition supporters are feeling exhausted.
It's kind of like a roller coaster of emotions. One day you wake up and feel like relief because something is happening finally, but then nothing happens. So you feel down again.
Also, Mira Jacobs' half-Jewish, half-Indian son was just 6 years old when he asked a question that stopped her in her tracks.
He said in this very sweet, chirpy little kid voice, are white people afraid of brown people? And, you know, we were on the subway when he said that, and the whole subway car went quiet.
Her son's questions inspired Jacob to write a graphic memoir about race in America. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. It's been a long, tense week for Venezuela, and it's ending with no clear resolution to the country's long political standoff. Just days ago, it seemed the crisis was at a breaking point. Tens of thousands of Venezuelans took to the streets on Tuesday after opposition leader Juan Guaido called for a popular and military uprising.
Now, we're asking all Venezuelans to take to the streets.
Guaido released a video where he was flanked by members of the Venezuelan military near an airbase in Caracas. The end seemed imminent for the government of President Nicolas Maduro. That afternoon, I spoke to Gustavo Mendoza, one of the protesters who was out on the streets of Caracas. He wasn't sure what would happen, but sounded hopeful.
It's a big sign that we saw military supporting Guaido today on the streets with guns. That, to me, is a very clear sign that something is happening.
Then the momentum seemed to change. The government declared the protests insignificant and a failed coup. Maduro himself went on TV, also flanked by members of the military, and he vowed to punish the protesters.
Hay que identificar a toda esa gente que disparó y irlos a buscar.
He said, we have to identify all the people who fired weapons and submit them to justice. Now it seems no one can say for sure which side in Venezuela has the upper hand, the government, backed by Cuba and Russia, or the U.S.-supported opposition. So we called Gustavo Mendoza today again to check in.
The general feeling of everyone here is confusion. The only way that we can get some information is via Twitter and Instagram, mostly. Social media. You feel a lot of frustration all the time, but I guess it's what it is. I mean, when you go out in the street, for example, today, everything is kind of back to normal. I mean, people on the streets are going to work and doing their stuff, and I mean, you don't see anything.
But do you think that there is movement, even if it's inch by inch, towards some sort of resolution to this crisis?
For sure, there is something going on. I mean, Juan Guaido, it's all over the place doing meetings and public meetings also. The thing is that he always speaks about the plan and what we are supposed to do, which is resist and stay on the streets and stuff like that. But they don't go into details. So we are not certain of what it's going on. But we know for sure that it's something that's going on right now, especially with the military. It's a lot of confusion. We are not certain about anything unless you are inside.
How are you feeling? I mean, personally, how's your mood?
It's kind of like a roller coaster of emotions. One day you wake up with Leopoldo López on the streets and you feel like relief because something is happening finally, but then it just vanishes because nothing happens. So you feel down again. And it's very hard, emotionally speaking, to stay up. But it's kind of like what we have to do. We have to resist because otherwise we lose. When we quit, when we give up, we lose.
As you know, several million Venezuelans have left the country. Are you considering leaving?
I already left and I came back. I was 5 years out of Venezuela. I was studying in Argentina and I came back in 2017. Which was like a very hard year with protests and stuff. There was like 4 months in a row of protests in the street. And we believed that we were going to achieve our freedom finally. And that didn't happen. But still, I believe that if we don't do this, I mean, if we don't fight here, we lose. And I'm not willing to give up. So I guess I'm going to stay here.
Do you find yourself having to convince your friends or family to hang in and keep protesting and...
Yeah. Yes. I mean, half and half. Some friends are willing to go out no matter what, and some are very disappointed at Juan Guaido because he haven't kicked Maduro out. They kind of like think that this is already lost, and it's hard because we need them to participate also. You have to keep on going, keep on trying. Every day is an everyday stuff.
Gustavo Mendoza is an independent photographer in Caracas. He's been speaking to us from the streets of the city, and we've been checking in with him periodically this week. Thanks a lot, Gustavo.
Goodbye. Okay. Thank you.
We've been reporting on the dramatic rise in the number of migrants being detained along the U.S.-Mexico border. The government has struggled to cope with those numbers. It doesn't have enough room at existing locations to hold asylum seekers after they're taken into custody. So the Trump administration is rolling out some new facilities. And the world's Monica Campbell just got a tour of one in El Paso, Texas. It's what officials are calling a soft-sided facility. So I asked Monica to describe what we're talking about exactly.
You won't hear the officials call them tents, but that's what they look like. They're large white structures, kind of warehouses inside, large rooms that are being designed to house hundreds of migrants. And so that's what we got a tour of yesterday.
And so these giant soft-sided facilities, or tents, families will live in them? Are they divided up by sections? And is there like kitchen space and bathrooms? How does it look?
Right. So they're divided up into sections. There are a couple of large areas where you'll have migrants sleep on these foam mattresses on the floor. And then they showed us where there are showers, there are trucks for doing laundry, and then there are these outdoor kind of dirt flat areas where people can go and walk around. So that's, and they're pretty bare bones. They're just large structures. No one was there. And the idea is that they'll be opening these perhaps today or in the coming days. And the particular tents that we saw will accommodate 500 migrants.
Is it 500 people in one tent?
Well, 500 people in these tent structures. So they're kind of a series of tents, two large tents divided up into sections. So you'll have, for example, unaccompanied minors, kids who are traveling alone, who were apprehended at the border. They'll have an area, and then families. And then you have divisions with gender, of course, for, you know, showering and things like that.
So what specific problem is Border Patrol addressing with these new tents? What will they accomplish?
I mean, the tents are really a consequence of a hardline approach by the Trump administration. I mean, what you have are thousands of migrants, many migrant families approaching the U.S.-Mexico border. And you can either go to a large port of entry like Juarez across from El Paso or Tijuana, you know, near San Diego, and get on these lists. It's very uncertain, you know, this list process, this metering process. So what we're seeing is people are choosing to enter the border and ask for asylum from border officials at other points of the border, more remote parts of the border. And those remote parts of the border, the Border Patrol facilities there are not equipped to receive large numbers of people. So these tents are meant to bring in the people apprehended in those more remote areas into a larger, kind of more centralized space that's more accommodating. Border Patrol officials say these are more humane conditions than being in some small cell on the border. That's not a place for a family. These are meant to be more accommodating for kids and families.
Monica, at what point in the sequence that happens when a migrant crosses the border and asks for asylum, what stage of that do these tents serve, these new facilities serve?
So in many ways, it's the similar point as when they're apprehended by Border Patrol at the border. But because Border Patrol stations are overwhelmed by the number of people arriving to the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly smaller Border Patrol stations, this tent serves as kind of, you could think of it as like a larger Border Patrol station. So it's still that first point of contact.
Monica, what do these new facilities, the need for these new facilities, say about the situation today for migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border?
It shows that there are people in larger numbers arriving to the U.S.-Mexico border, and that the U.S. government has these makeshift tents to try and address the overflow that we're seeing as they appear, the migrants, at many different points along the border in larger groups. We're not seeing a large comprehensive plan to deal with the number of migrants that we're seeing come from Central America mostly.
One thing I have to ask is, you know, this week we talked about this very sad story of the 16-year-old Guatemalan boy, a migrant who died in U.S. custody this week. And I'm wondering if these new tent facilities provide a better way to check the health of incoming migrants.
So that was definitely a question a lot of reporters had during this tour, especially considering recent deaths of children at the border and some in the hands of government custody. We were told that there would be medical personnel at these facilities 24/7. And we were told at bare minimum, there would be one doctor, a nurse, and perhaps a medical technician. Those are mostly contracted out. We kind of didn't get hard detail on that. But if this place is holding 500 people, that's what we're told we'll see. It seemed a little lacking in information during the tour, frankly, especially considering how much the health of migrants is in the news, particularly migrant children. So this definitely is a question that I want to get more detail about.
The World's Monica Campbell in El Paso, Texas, where she just toured some new so-called soft-sided facilities that border officials will use to temporarily house migrants coming over the border applying for asylum. Thanks, Monica.
You're welcome.
Challenging a longtime leader can be dangerous. Bobi Wine is an opposition politician and activist in Uganda, but most people there know him as a musician who's taken on Uganda's apparent president for life, Yoweri Museveni. Bobi Wine has been arrested a few times, and last fall, he says he was tortured in detention, which the government denies. Last month, while he was under house arrest, he wrote this song. It's called Afande.
Why beat me na misi na tafauti na we? Why kick me na mimi sina shida na we?
Afande is a Swahili word meaning a military superior. Bobi Wine goes on to sing, "There's no difference between me and you. Before you became a soldier or police officer, you were an ordinary citizen."
I'm fighting for you and for me. Watoto wangu.
Earlier this week, Bobi Wine was arrested yet again for leading a protest over taxes. He was released on bail today. When he was in Boston last fall getting treatment for the injuries he sustained in detention, he told my colleague Marco Werman that he won't stop speaking out.
Because I know back in Uganda, many people, even those who don't speak out, have suffered the brunt of misgovernance. So I will continue standing for the truth, even when it means paying a price for it.
Bobi Wine's not the only one getting a warning from Ugandan authorities for speaking freely. This week, the Ugandan government suspended 30 journalists for writing about Bobi Wine's latest arrest.
Why you really want to keep your people down? Yote unafanya, kuna wakati wakulipa. Yote unapanda, diyo utavuna. Banji babandeo, ngakwe bolivo.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Kids are full of questions. Why is the sky blue? What happened to the dinosaurs? Why does red mean stop and green mean go? Why this? Why that? And sometimes, thank God, you have the answers. But other times, it's more complicated. Author Mira Jacob got a lot of difficult questions from her six-year-old son. He's half Jewish and half Indian, and he got curious about identity, people's skin color, and things he was hearing on the news. Jacob answers some of her son's questions in her latest book, Good Talk, a memoir in conversations. When she started, Jacob thought it would be a really funny book about the conversations she and her child were having.
But as I was writing it, what was actually happening in America was, well, my son was six. He was very obsessed with Michael Jackson. We had all of the Michael Jackson albums in his room, and he was staring at them. Now, I'm an East Indian woman. I'm brown, and my husband is Jewish and white. My son's skin goes somewhere between us, and he was staring at them and realizing kind of the obvious thing that we all as adults know, which is that Michael Jackson's skin color changes over time. And he was asking me a lot of questions about that.
What kind of questions was your son asking you about Michael Jackson?
Some of them were just funny and ridiculous. Did he lose his other glove? Is that how people really walk on the moon? Some of them were, you know, the first time he asked me about skin color specifically, he said, you know, is Michael Jackson, is he brown or is he white? And they said, well, he's black. It means his skin is brown. And then he sort of turned white. And he said, he turned white? And I said, yeah. And he said, are you going to turn white? And I said, no, no. And he said, am I going to turn white? And I said, no, you're not going to turn white. And he said, is daddy? And I said, daddy's already white. And he said, but was he always? It was this moment where I realized that I had kind of a fundamental communication breakdown, but also that these things that I sort of took for granted were going to require a little more thought on my part. And still later, he said, just kind of out of the blue in this very sweet, chirpy little kid voice, are white people afraid of brown people? And, you know, we were on the subway when he said that, and the whole subway car went quiet, which is an unusual thing, as you know. And I realized how, and I was sort of calibrating the races of everyone around us, the way they were waiting for me to answer the question, then also the weight of my son's face turned to me, and I didn't want to lie to him, and I didn't want to tell him the truth either. And I ended up saying sometimes, you know, and it was just, it was the weight of those conversations that sort of led me to kind of write the book.
You wrestle, you and your character, and your son, you all wrestle not only with being people of color in America, but also the attitudes of your own family, your own South Asian family toward color. What are the kind of things you wrestled with them in terms of their attitudes?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that is well known in South Asia and somehow less known over here is the idea of what's a good color of skin to have, which is fair. You know, somebody like me with darker skin is called dusky. When I went back to India when I was about 5 was the first time that I heard some aunties talking about it. And they were saying, what happened, though? The mother is okay. The father is okay. Even the boy is okay. That's my brother. But the little one, what happened to her? And I had to ask my mom. I wasn't sure what it meant. And I asked my brother. My mother sort of shrugged it off. She said, don't worry about it. My brother said, doofus, it means that you're dark. And that was the first time I kind of realized, oh, I'm different than my family. And my father said this thing I think he meant very sweetly, where when I was asking him about it, he said, oh, don't worry about what the aunties say. You're a pretty girl. I knew when he said that, I thought, oh, dark means ugly.
So in some ways, there's a parallel between your son asking you questions and you asking your own parents questions.
Very much so. I think a lot of what happened for probably many people like me was there was a set of assumptions we had about this America that we were going to get to as a nation, the sort of promise of we are getting better every year, we are figuring this out. And I remember thinking when I was a kid, by the time I'm an adult, all the ways in which I feel like an outsider, they're going to go away. We will have grown past this. I really had to come to grips with that fantasy I had.
You encounter similar but different contextual attitudes with your in-laws and their friends. Tell us what happened at a party you were at that your mother-in-law was giving.
So my mother-in-law is a great party giver. She threw a bar mitzvah for the family dog. There were little talises for the dogs. It was amazing. I was helping her get ready. I was 6 months pregnant and a couple friends came. I let them in and I said, can I get you some wine? And somewhere in the middle of the party and, you know, everyone was there, all the dogs were there, everyone was running around. And one of the men handed me his glass and said, I'll have a little more white, please. And I took the glass, because I was also helping host, and I went to the kitchen, and I thought, oh, my God. Whew, okay. He thinks that I am here as the help. And I went back, and I gave him his glass, and his friend said, oh, I'll have a little more, too. There's a line that I say in the book, which is that I wanted not to take the glass. And I thought about not taking the glass, and I watched myself take it anyway, and I hated myself for doing it. And that was painful, but telling my mother-in-law about that later was equally painful because her first response was, that can't be true. That can't be something that's really happening.
Sort of denying your own experience.
Yeah, denying and saying, and, you know, just saying like, I just can't imagine someone doing that to you. Are you sure? And, you know, just having to weigh out, do I tell her? Do I say, no, this is absolutely what happened? So either way, you lose the white in-laws' perception of having an easy relationship with you, something that's, you know, a joy to navigate, or you lose a little bit of yourself when you know that you're hiding that part because it's inconvenient for them.
What's been the reaction to Good Talk?
You know, I've been really pleasantly surprised. The entire time I was writing this book, I was terrified. America's scary right now. I don't know that it's easy to be anyone, but it's definitely not easy to be a brown woman with a brown boy. I've had plenty of harassment online. I have been so gratified by how many people have reached out to me. I think I get like 10 letters a day right now.
Wow.
From people that say, this is my story. And I'm not Indian and my husband's not Jewish and I'm not this and I'm not that, but this is our story. I think it's been really hard for mixed race families. America has this fantasy that if you're in an interracial relationship, then you must understand everything about each other. And it's a real kumbaya fantasy and this is the future and it's all love. And that's not true.
Any response from your in-laws or your aunties?
They just went out in India, so I'm curious about how they feel. But my in-laws, I sent them the book before it published. And I said, this is the book I wrote. I hope you see the love in here. You know, they wrote me right away and said, you know, we read it. Thank you for sending it. We're not ready to talk about it. We love you so much.
Hmm.
And I think that is the really hard part of this. And that's the part that people don't know what to do with, is they do love me. They're active Trump supporters. They are still actively building a world for me and my son that does not love us. They love us, though. And that's the hard part.
Mira Jacob is the author of Good Talk, a memoir in conversations. Thanks a lot, Mira.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. On this World Press Freedom Day, a Russian journalist says it's hard to know exactly how risky his job is these days.
It's not like old school totalitarian Soviet Union. It's more like some medieval, very complicated structure where you never know.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. For President Trump, the U.S.-Saudi relationship boils down to this.
Saudi Arabia, very rich country.
Trump was speaking at a campaign rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin last Saturday.
You know, you had people wanting to cut off Saudi Arabia. They bought $450 billion. I don't want to lose them.
It's not exactly clear where Trump draws that $450 billion figure from. Several reports conclude the president is vastly overestimating the Saudi financial contribution to the U.S. economy. So why is this important? Because critics of the president say he's prioritizing the economic benefit. So why is this important? Because critics of the president say he's prioritizing the economic benefit. Sorry. It's not exactly clear where Trump draws that $450 billion figure from. Several reports conclude the president is vastly overestimating the Saudi financial contribution to the U.S. economy. So why is this important? Because critics of the president say he's prioritizing the economic benefit while ignoring the kingdom's human rights abuses. You might remember the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi last year. Then came the arrests and torture of women's rights activists. And now the largest mass execution in 3 years. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
37 men were beheaded last week in Saudi Arabia. Most of them were Shiites, a persecuted minority in the mostly Sunni kingdom. Executions are not rare in Saudi Arabia, says Ahmad Ben Shamsi of Human Rights Watch.
Only this year, in 2019, Saudi Arabia has carried out over 100 executions so far.
But what's different, he says, is the broader uptick in human rights violations since Mohammed bin Salman became crown prince in 2017.
Since he arrived, there have been an intensified crackdown against dissidents, even businessmen and fellow princes, massive execution of people who did not benefit from due process in court.
The Saudi government has provided little information about the crimes of the executed men. According to Ben Shamsi, some of them were convicted of spying for Iran, Saudi Arabia's main rival in the region. and others were convicted of taking part in anti-government protests.
They received the hardest punishment under Islamic law, and those include beheading and displaying the corpse of the beheaded.
The Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. emailed a statement saying that all of the men, quote, had their day in court and were found guilty of very serious violent crimes, unquote. That includes Mujtaba al-Suwaikit, who was 17 years old when he was arrested.
When I heard what happened like a couple of days ago, I was in a shock and I couldn't even believe it because it's just unbelievable what happened to him.
Ali Tinai is a student at Western Michigan University. That's where Suwaikit was headed in 2012. He was planning to study English and finance. But before he was able to board the flight to the U.S., he was arrested. Suwaikit was then accused of taking part in anti-government protests. And last week, he was beheaded.
Our school is like in a big shock.
Western Michigan University did publicize Suwaikit's case. In 2017, about 100 faculty and administrators signed a petition urging President Trump to intervene. Michigan State Representative John Hoadley says he also wrote to Trump about Suwaikit.
I was calling on President Trump as a voice for thousands of people in my area who wanted to see his safe return.
It's not clear if the Trump administration brought up the case with the Saudis. The State Department said in a statement that, quote, the U.S. calls on all governments to ensure that no death penalty is imposed on a defendant who was a minor at the time of the arrest or alleged crime, end quote. Hoadley, though, believes the U.S. should have done more for Suwaikit.
Hearing the news of the beheading and the execution was just a punch in the gut. This was not an act that had to happen. And it sends a message across the globe that we are falling behind on human rights.
And while the mass executions last week shocked many, for Abdullah al-Odeh, the despair rises to another level. Al-Odeh's father is currently in prison in Saudi Arabia. He's been sentenced to death. So any news of executions sends his heart racing.
It worries me and it worries a lot of people in Saudi Arabia. So when I tweet about my father, a lot of people follow and get, you know, concerned and ask me about him. So, yeah, it's really worrying.
Al-Odeh's father, Salman Al-Odeh, is a prominent Saudi cleric. Before he was arrested in 2017, he had a big social media following.
He was followed by so many millions on Facebook, and he was followed on Snapchat and also on Twitter. He was followed on Twitter alone by almost 14 million people, which is double than the king.
This is Al-Odeh the father in a video he posted on Twitter. According to his son, he preached about human rights, equality, and Islamic values. Then, in 2017, he apparently crossed the line. Al-Odeh posted a tweet about Qatar, the Persian Gulf country, which has tense relations with the Saudi government. A few hours later, security forces showed up at his home in Riyadh and took him away.
For 5 or 6 months, we didn't know if he was alive or dead.
Last September, the courts brought 37 charges against him.
Mocking the government achievement, calling to change the system into a constitutional monarchy, possessing some books that are banned in the kingdom.
Fearing for his safety, the younger Al-Odeh moved to Washington, D.C. I ask him if he's reached out to American officials about his father. Al-Odeh prefers not to say. But he points out that the recent executions in Saudi Arabia should be a lesson for the Trump administration and its unwavering support for the Crown Prince, also known as MBS.
He may be running the kingdom right now, but he's an unstable person who waged war against a neighboring country, blockaded another country, cut ties with Canada over a tweet, put a prime minister of a foreign country, which is the Al-Hariri, under house arrest. He did all these atrocities in the region. So if you care about the region, let alone if you care about human rights, you should care about not putting all the eggs in the basket of MBS.
Al-Odeh says he understands that when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia, the United States puts its own financial and political interests first. But, he adds, it's also in the U.S. interest to build bridges with the Saudi people. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The U.S. is now a problematic place for journalists to work. That word comes from an annual report by the group Reporters Without Borders. Never before have U.S. journalists been subjected to so many death threats, the report reads. And it puts the U.S. at number 48 in the World Press Freedom Index. For comparison, Russia is ranked 149th out of 180 countries, making it one of the worst places for journalists to work. But that doesn't stop Roman Dobrohotov. He leads the investigative reporting outlet called Insider. The World's Marco Werman met him on a park bench in Moscow this morning to talk about the role of journalists in Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Here we are on World Press Freedom Day. If there's anybody who can give us an accurate assessment of how free the press is in Russia, it would be you, Roman. So what are the risks that you take when you decide to launch an investigation? Are there certain subjects that you will just not touch?
Usually we touch only the topics that are dangerous. And the more dangerous it is, the main priority it is for us, because that is forbidden for some reason, right? That is forbidden because that is very sensitive for the government. So we make investigations about, for example, links of Vladimir Putin and his team with organized crime. We made investigations on the most important international scandals, such as Skripal poisoning or war in Ukraine, and especially MH17.
Malaysian Airlines flight that was shot down over Donbass.
Yes, where we found at least two Russian generals who were involved directly there, and we've identified their real names. So this is like the most dangerous topics, and we choose them because we know that if we want to be journalists, we have to prioritize these topics that have the most political and social effect.
When we spoke in March, at the time you did not feel an immediate threat to the work that you were doing. Is that still the case for you or anyone else at The Insider?
I wouldn't say that I don't feel a threat, but of course I understand that I can be killed or imprisoned anytime, but the problem here is that you never know where is the red line, because before we started our investigations, many, many journalists in Russia would say that this is the red line, and if you cross this, you will be killed. And we crossed them, and we survived. Because this is, you know, a very, very complicated system. It's not like old-school totalitarian Soviet Union. It's more like some medieval, very complicated structure where you never know. So it is very difficult, even from inside, to understand.
So you've taken these risks, you and the other journalists at The Insider. What keeps you going?
Well, actually, I used to be a political activist. So for me, journalism is maybe some continuation of activism, because it's not enough to say that Russia is corrupted. You need to find proof. You need to empower people with information. And of course, I understand that this is risky. But, you know, risk is also must be compared with something, right? So it is risky in comparison with those journalists who write about football. But if we compare it with, for example, our grandparents who fight for freedom with Hitler, for example, or if you compare it with Soviet dissidents, right? So in comparison with this, we live now in very different society with very different risks. So it would be very stupid to be afraid in this context.
So on this World Press Freedom Day in 2019, on a scale of 0 to 10, where would you rank Russia today?
So North Korea would be 0 and 10 would be like Canada, right? I think that Russia would be somewhere around 4, possibly. I would say that it used to be around 6 several years ago, because we had much more free internet. We had very big internet media outlets. They still exist, but they changed their owners and their editors, so they're not as dangerous for the government as they used to be.
So a 4 out of 10, some ways to go.
Yeah, so I think the most important time will be in several years, actually, because no one knows what Vladimir Putin wants to do in 2024. According to the constitution, he cannot be re-elected, so he would need to make a new move to make Russia more authoritarian, and everybody understands that it would be illegitimate. So this will be kind of like final struggle, final fight between the society and Vladimir Putin. And maybe even earlier, before 2024, he would do some steps to change the constitution and to change this political system. So very soon we will see this final battle. Actually, I'm very optimistic about this because I see that Putin has the lowest support rating in his political history. So I think that we would have the best chances to change the system in several years.
Well, Roman Dobrokhotov with The Insider here in Moscow, thanks very much for meeting us.
Thank you for having me.
Read more about the World Press Freedom Index in English or in Russian at our website, theworld.org. And for more of Marco's reporting in Russia, check our Instagram stories at PRI The World. A quick change of pace now. We're going to talk about smiling. You might assume that the meaning of a smile is universal, that everyone around the globe interprets a smile the same way. But that's not what our friends from the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast tell us. The Fifth Floor features journalists from all the different language services of the BBC. And when they compared notes recently, they found out there were all sorts of ways to interpret a smile. Fifth Floor host David Amanor and BBC Uzbek's Ibrat Safo get us started.
If you saw someone smiling in a Tashkent street, what would you think?
Well, there's a joke among some of my friends. If you see someone smiling in the street, they're either mad or drunk or American.
Or American.
This was from an American friend, so no offense.
Oh, when you smiling.
I am Suchira Magwai from BBC Thai. Well, you know, Thailand, we are kind of the land of smile. So in Thailand, it's quite common for people to just smile at everything. When you feel embarrassed, you are shy, you have nothing to do, you just smile. But if you go to work in Bangkok, I wouldn't smile at someone a bit more senior than me. It's not being rude, but it's a bit odd. Think about the Queen. You can't talk to the Queen first. The Queen will have to speak to you first.
I smile. Disappears.
I'm Khalid Berud and I work for the BBC Somali Service. Smiling is a normal part of life in Somalia. You smile at everybody you see, family members, strangers. And Somalis have this saying, whatever your colleagues or your peers are going through, if they're going through the same trials and tribulations as you are, then that's something to smile at.
My name is Oksana Vazdeva of BBC Russian. In Russia, smiling is not really a common thing. It looks suspicious for us, to be honest. Because, you know, when you see people on the street and they smile to you, you think immediately whether it's something wrong with him or it's something wrong with me. Maybe you did bad makeup or, you know, funny hairdress or your shoes is not clean or something. So it looks very suspicious.
Our colleagues from the BBC Fifth Floor podcast comparing notes about the meaning of a smile. Okay, we're going to end our week by taking you on an amorous musical tour of Europe. The World's Brandy Fullwood explains.
Gemma Payton and James Stenhouse had this idea. They would travel around Europe collecting love songs from strangers. So for 6 months, they got in an RV with a recording studio in it and hit the road. When they arrived in a nice open space in the center of a city, they'd park this RV.
It's like decorated and it looks, it looks like something out of the ordinary is happening in there. Occasionally some people would come in and try to order a coffee because they thought we were a coffee truck or something.
They put up two big signs and wrote, "We're collecting love songs and do you know a love song?"
And then we would just sort of... And then we'll just wait and see who came.
He wants to sing a song that he knows in Greek. Okay.
Anyone that came by and wanted to sing a song, Gemma and James recorded them.
Na 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 na.
Some people sang well-known tunes.
Na 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 na.
And
for some reason, also Celine Dion songs?
Always groups of girls, groups of teenage girls who want to sing Celine Dion together.
Near, far, wherever you are, I believe that the hardest go on.
Even so, there were loads of people who wanted to sing traditional songs and folk songs and their own songs.
Das du der Leichte bist, ist was du weißt.
This is a song from the Netherlands. Despite all the pop music, this is more or less the kind of song people wanted to share.
Komm bitte nacht, komm bitte nacht, sag how du heißt.
Probably less than 5% of the songs are English language. Most people, when invited to sing, most people want to sing in their mother tongue. We knew that the project was going to be thinking about Europe in some way, about the future of Europe, about how we continue to share space together.
Of course, that's changing with Brexit. And that thought flooded Gemma's mind throughout the trip.
In the UK, like, even if you go to the supermarket to buy a loaf of bread, it's somehow that's still about Brexit.
Yeah, it's not quite like that outside the UK.
For the rest of Europe, Brexit isn't really a thing.
People didn't really bring up Brexit. In all, Gemma and James collected more than 700 songs in 33 countries, songs from people who are able to trace their European ancestry back hundreds of years.
Eu queria falar com ela. O pai quis, a mãe não deixava. O pai quis, a mãe não deixava.
And songs from people born outside Europe, who emigrated there more recently.
Halim Hayarni, Halim Saharni, Alashya Qalbi, Alashya Qalbi, Alash Mahani.
Even when you don't understand the language, you know it's about love. You can kind of tell by the lovesick croons and saccharine melodies. It's rich and intimate at times.
Ponme la mano aquí en mi corazón, por Dios, mariquito. Ponme la mano aquí en mi corazón, que no me palpito. Ponme la mano aquí. Ponme la mano aquí.
There's something about tuning into love, I suppose.
Love like two people and all that bliss and heartbreak.
I'm a pretty emotional person. I would cry a lot during this project.
But sometimes the songs were about more than two people, like way more, a whole nation and a whole continent. Yeah, Brexit. You can't really escape Brexit on this one.
We were driving around Europe on what was, at that time, was going to be the last summer, you know, that we were... that British people were members of the EU. So, you know, on a personal level, for me, that there's a real sadness to that. Of course, I know that not everybody in Britain feels that way. So for me, there's this great sort of personal melancholy about it, you know, sort of like this long goodbye, you know, or this sort of love letter.
A love letter that Gemma and James made possible. I asked Gemma, among all of these songs, which one stayed with her? One of them, she said, was someone else's love letter.
A woman came in Romania to the van and she'd heard about the project in advance and she brought with her her diary. And in her diary was from 50 years ago, a love letter that someone had written her. And in this love letter, they had written her a love song and she sang that love song for us.
Maria, flore alba de mai, Maria.
So, you know, in that sort of situation, you think, like, I don't know, she's kind of carried this song with her for 5 decades, you know, and then it's like this incredible act of generosity to share it.
Tu mi-ai apărut azi în cale, cum apar norii printre petale, de acum strălucești în viața mea, micuță stea, Maria.
Gemma and James aren't done recording just yet. They still want to find more people and voices that they may have left out. And they're getting back on the road this summer, actually.
If you're in Europe and you see like a sort of a funny looking van, then it's probably us. And come and sing for us if you like.
Ενοχώσιμα απέναντι σου τα πάμε, μα αγαπώ, αγαπάμε.
For the world, I'm Brandy Fuller.
Δρόμος να περάσεις, πατάμε.
Gemma Payton and James Stenhouse have put all of the love songs they've collected on a website. Usually you have to be in Europe to stream the songs, but today anyone can listen to them. The collection is streaming live over on oeuropa.com right now. That's oeuropa.com. And that's all from us. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend and see you back here on Monday.
Αγαπάμε γιατί να ζήσω χώρια σου δεν γίνεται νεράκι η ζωή μου και θα χύνεται στις πέτρες δίχως νόημα γι' αυτό αγαπάμε και σκέψου δυστυχώς πως παρασύρωμε και γύρε πάλι επάνω μου να γύρουμε αγάπη μόνο αγάπη σου ζητώ.
PRI, Public Radio International.